Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, do you remember the story of Phineas Gage? Maybe something you read in a psychology textbook. It's about a railroad worker who survived getting an iron rod through his head. Well, Jamberry the horse recently had a similar experience. I will talk with her vet about the bizarre injury and remarkable recovery of Jamberry. But first, Nathan Timmel is a stand-up comedian. He lives in the Iowa City area, but he performs all over the country. And being away from home got a lot harder when he became a dad. And a few years ago, he started filling his empty hours in far-flung hotel rooms by writing letters to his kids. First his daughter. Those letters became the book It's Okay to Talk to Animals. And now he's published his letters to his son in Hey Buddy, Dubious Advice from Dad. And Nathan Timmel is here with me now. Hey Nathan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, let's talk about how these letters got started. We talked when you published your letters to your daughter, but remind us of what triggered this.
My wife, she read a single letter online. I believe it was a letter to a toddler, and she liked it so much that she said, "Oh, we should do that for our kids." And by we, I mean you, because you have all the time in the hotel rooms. And when I say do a letter, I mean write a lot of letters because you're in hotel rooms a lot. So she liked what she read and put all the effort onto me to turn it into something. So I did.
Well, and when you started doing it, I mean, it's one thing to write a letter to a child and write it to the child as if they are kind of at that frozen moment in time. But you have chosen to write to your kids many years from now as adults. In some ways.
Yes and no. That's, I think, maybe a flaw in what I'm doing, because I do both. Like, there are moments where I definitely write to them as, wow, you are 2 years old and this is what we are experiencing. But then there are other topics where it's like, you need to read this at 15, 16, 17, 20. Like, I don't know. And time is a bit fluid, and I hope that's not confusing. And I point that out, I think, in the first one, like, hey, if you get into this and I'm writing something that seems awkward, you know, hopefully you can differentiate between when I'm writing to a two-year-old and when I'm going to give them something in the future.
Right. Well, it's not confusing to me, but I do wonder how you think about when your kids read these books. Like, when will you give them a chance? Because they're going to be readers here pretty quick.
Yeah, that's the thing is I don't know. But the thing is, they're kids and I'm their dad, which means they will probably have an inherent disinterest in them. Like, yeah, Dad, you wrote to me, whatever. Like, they don't listen to me now. So why would they want to sit down and read a bunch of things? It's just like a book of lecturing probably to them. I have no idea. But that's, you know, they'd probably be interested in outside sources, hearing from them, as opposed to, oh, that's just Dad rattling on again. He always just talks or writes or just shut up, Dad. Just shut up.
How old are your kids right now?
Right now, they're 3 and 5. I think for both of them, I wrote as they were 1 turning to 2, I believe, in that little area there.
And thinking about that, I mean, of course, you had to be fair because with 2 kids pretty close together, you have to be absolutely fair all the time or you hear about it pretty quickly.
That's why I wrote the second book, is literally because even if he never reads it, my son can never come back at me like, you don't love me as much as you love her, and guilt me and say, you wrote her a book and never wrote me a book. So I wrote him a book. He can ignore it, but he can't hold it over in my head that she got favoritism.
Well, it makes me wonder, you know, you focused on your daughter in the first book. You focused on your son in the second book. Was it kind of difficult to just write to him? Because, of course, with a big sister at home, I mean, that's a big world. A 4-year-old, a 5-year-old, they take up a lot of the oxygen in the room.
It's not like she's a ghost in this second book, but I did try and make sure it was focused on him. And there were times where I felt like I was writing about an experience I had with her and how I would correct that with him in the future. Like, I made this mistake with with your sister, and hopefully I'm going to do better by you. Because the first child is just a learning experience. You have no clue what you're doing, so it's just devil may care, and hopefully I learned a few lessons in the 2 years I had her before he came along. Crossed fingers. I have no clue.
Right.
They could both end up in therapy and say, nope, you messed up both of us. I don't know.
Well, it's an interesting time to focus on, too, because, you know, obviously once a child starts developing, there are all these leaps and changes. But most of the time that you're focusing on with each child in the books is when they're pre-verbal. They can't say much to you.
Right. And so I'm just sort of looking at them and I'm trying to get in their head. And what are you thinking? And what will I have to teach you? And how will I get this information to you? And I maybe this is just my ego talking. I think I picked a pretty good time to write in, because once they turn three and start getting verbal, oh, they complain and cry and whine and want and point. And the books would have a much different tone. Like, today you were such a whiny complaining. I just put you in timeout. That was it. I couldn't even deal with you. So I picked a time when they're still magical and you love them and nothing goes wrong. Now they fight with one another, so I wouldn't want a series of letters of how much they fought over a toy for 3 hours during
right,
one day.
Right. So what was your writing process like with these letters? They cover such an incredible wide variety of subjects. What was it that made you think, oh, this is going to make it into one of these letters?
It just as it happened. Like, literally, if, hey, today we went for coffee, that's not going to be a letter. It's just boring, you know. There's something that sparks in everyday life, and either it's really interesting or it's not. And over the course of 7 days, like, I tried to write a letter a week because I'm away from home on the weekend. So on that Friday night after the show or Saturday in the hotel room, I would think back on the week, or maybe I'd take a note on Wednesday, like, oh, we just did this, you know, write about it. And if I didn't have any notes in my head, then there was nothing to write about. So that means hopefully it wasn't interesting and only the best of the best made it into the book.
Well, and sometimes some of the things you respond to, we'll talk about some of them in just a moment. Some of them are very, very serious things going on in the world, things that you'd want to have a heart-to-heart conversation with about a few years down the road. Sometimes I got the impression that it was something that just got you riled up, and instead of having a fight on social media, you know what? I'll tell my son about this.
Yeah, I used to. And maybe I'm just getting old and mellowing, and hopefully that's the case, that I'm not getting more cranky with age. But I used to enjoy, you know, just flame wars on going back to MySpace or now Facebook, where you just put something out there and people would react and just giggle and eat popcorn and just sort of poke them and egg them along. Now I don't do that much anymore. I'll still put my opinions out there, but once the fight starts, I just sort of back off, like, all right, this is going to solve nothing. You guys just fight on there. I'll see what I take away from this, the reaction people give, as opposed to re-reacting to their reaction and steamrolling and just being a bundle of negativity and fighting online.
Well, before we jump into some of the more serious subjects that you tackle, would you read just a little bit from the book to give us, this is one of the more lighthearted letters, a moment in time that you capture.
Sure. And fair warning, I didn't rehearse this, so if I stumble over my own words, it's because I don't know how to read that well. Okay. This comes from April 20th, and I left the year off. So, hey, buddy. I am in Dubuque, Iowa, smiling while I write. It has begun, the process of you emulating your sister. I didn't know when it would happen, but it is an adorable little phase you are in. Since she could speak, sister would see an airplane in the sky and yell, "Airplane!" Now you follow suit, doing the best you can, shouting, "Airplane!" That's right, airplane. You're not sure about your L's yet, which makes it adorable to a parent, as you point and shout all the more, and it's fun and exciting to hear. The two of you also scan the daytime sky for the moon, and when you find it, you draw out the O, saying, "Moon!" excitedly. The two of you doing these things bursts my heart, growing it three times every time you do it.
You also go on to write about how he has copied a bizarre little ritual that she has with your dog, whose name is Kitty, where to give Kitty a treat, she would put the treat on her head.
Yeah, for no reason. She would just literally, you'd give her a doggy treat to give to the dog, and she would put it on her head and then just tilt her head forward, and it would fall onto the floor. And she just thought that was amusing. So then he started doing it, and it makes no sense to me. It made no sense to me, and I don't get it. But I would like to say this has nothing to do with anything, but the dog's name is Kitty, and before the first child was born, we got flack from everybody. You know, when you have kids, they're going to be confused by that. You're going to warp your kids. They're not going to understand. They got it right away. They say, we have a doggy named Kitty and the cat named Simon. They just look at her. They go, there's our doggy. His name is Kitty. There's our cat. His name is Simon. They weren't confused at all. People don't give kids enough credit for being smart or able to figure things out, I think.
What I love about that story, though, is the influence of the big sister. You know, with the first child, the parents have parents obviously have a lot of influence anyway, but you're the primary role models. And then with a second child, suddenly this child that's not very much older becomes the primary role model. It's fascinating to watch.
And we got lucky, and I know this will change, and I'm not looking forward to it, and it's just going to be horrible. But right now, they love one another. They adore one another. My daughter will, like, when he gets in his booster chair, she'll, like, I'll push you in, and go pushes his chair in. And when we pick her up from daycare or from school, from kindergarten, I pick him up first, and he goes wandering in to find her and gives her a big hug, and then she picks him up and, you know, shakes him. And I just love it. And I'm just going to hold on to this as much as possible for when they're 15 and, I want the car. No, I want the car. I hate you. I hate you. And they just don't like each other, and it's going to be horrible.
Oh, you may get lucky.
Not looking forward to it.
We have our kids are a similar age difference. They're about 2 years apart. And one night, I have the same, an older daughter and a younger son. And one night when we were going to bed, my son said to me, Mama, I love you more than I love Daddy. And I love Audrey more than I love you. I thought, well, you summed it up pretty perfectly. Fortunately, he loved us all a lot.
Well, I hope my wife is listening right now, because it makes her feel better, I assume, that because she got that last night from our daughter. She's like, I don't want you to tuck me in. I want Daddy. I want Daddy. Because, you know, our son, loves her, and she loves me. We have a daddy's girl and a mama's boy. But she was upset by that. She was really, see, sweetie, if you're out there listening, it just happens. Kids choose a parent or someone else to like better than you, and it'll be fluid.
It is. It's always, always fluid. So capturing these moments in time, when you go back and look at the letters that you wrote to your daughter, do you remember the things that you captured there?
Yeah. And I need to do more of them, because there are moments where I write something. Like, I remember she wanted me to read her a book once, and it was nap time, and I was like, no, go to bed. I don't want to read you the book. And then she started crying, and I felt horrible, and I read her the book, and she said, thank you, Daddy. And I'm like, oh, why didn't I just read her the book? I need to be a better dad. And then life goes on, and I act like a, you know, jerk again. I'm like, I've got to be a better person. So I need to read those letters and maintain the message I wrote to myself.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. I'm talking with Nathan Timmel. He's a stand-up comedian, and his latest book is Hey Buddy, Dubious Advice from Dad. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest right now is Nathan Timmel. He's a stand-up comedian and also an author, and he just published a new book. It's called Hey Buddy, Dubious Advice from Dad. It's filled with letters to his infant and toddler son. And Nathan, we were talking about the wide variety of topics that you take on in these letters. Some letters would be appropriate to read to a four-year-old. Some letters maybe you don't want your son to look at until he's 16 or 17 years old. Some of the things that you write about, like I'll bring an example up, the massacre that took place in Orlando at the nightclub at Pulse.
Yeah.
You write a letter to your son about that. And I was struck by that, because the fact that you were writing to your son about it, I feel like it changed the way that you thought about it, because you weren't just thinking about it as someone reacting to that horror, but you were thinking about the dad of the man who perpetrated that horrible crime. Does it change your view of the world?
I don't know if it changed my view of the world, but I think becoming a dad myself changed my view of something like the massacre in Orlando, where I think I say it two different points in the book, if not three. I know there's another one in there where I believe I actively say that father failed that son. And in that specific case of the Orlando massacre, I have the father saying that homosexuals will go to hell. And it is the belief that the shooter may have been that way. And if he's raised full of self-loathing because, well, my dad says that what I am is horrible and I'm a sinner and I'm going to, and then he lashes out and hurts other people. Instead of being loving and inclusive, that dad failed his son. He raised him to hate a group of people that that son might have been a part of, and that was the reaction. And I don't know, this is all speculation, but I do know it begins at home. Whatever was going on in that man as he fired the gun and killed and hurt those people, something, it could have been avoided, I believe. Not everything can be avoided, but there was something in the way the father spoke that gave clues that it could have been avoided had there been more love or inclusiveness or tolerance for other people just in that household under that roof.
Well, I think about that instance and, you know, there was so much heartbreak. And I think every parent, almost every parent, you know, looks at a situation like that and think, you know, that my kid could have been there. My kid could have been killed that night. I find it interesting that you thought about the parenting of the father of the murderer. And wanted your son someday to take a lesson from that.
I'm gonna push back a little against what you said. Like, I think in that case, I think it was somewhat dismissed in where you say my child could have been there because it was a gay nightclub. And I think a lot of people thought, well, okay, that, like Newton, Connecticut, people would say that could have been my kid. I think the pulse got a little sort of slight, like, oh, that wouldn't be my kid. That was in the gay community. But from my point of view, when I was in my 20s, I worked at a fine dining restaurant, so every waiter was gay, and every waitress wanted to hang out with the waiters. So, you know, they're like, ooh, this is neat and clicky. So I spent a lot of time in gay bars. I could have been there as a straight guy. I could have been there and got shot just because that's where I hung out in my 20s. So I don't know. The thing is that I think people did dismiss it, saying, well, that's in the gay community. It happened there. That couldn't happen to me. But it could happen anywhere. It could happen to anyone. Just, I don't know.
Right now, of course, we're having a lot of difficult conversations, a lot of us parents to kids having difficult conversations, but also just the general public talking about sexual harassment and sexual assault, which is something that you also tackle in your letters to your son. In particular, there was the rape sentencing of a student at Stanford that took place while you were writing these letters to your son, sentencing that got a lot of public outcry because it seemed like the young man, when he received his sentence, the concern was more for him and his future than for the victim in that case. And you wanted to respond to that. What did you want to say to your son about that?
I like anybody, I think you say there was a public outcry. It seemed like there was deserved public outcry. If you don't remember the case, it was he got sentenced 3 months for giving a woman just something she had to live with the rest of her life, a violation, an attack. And it was just, it was absurd that father actively wrote a letter to the judge saying, hey, you know, he got caught. Isn't that enough? He has to live with this on his conscience for the rest of his life. And I was disgusted that father paid no attention to the victim. So I wrote a letter about consent to my son and what it means to hear the word no and what it means if you are with a woman that is too drunk, if you're at a girl like high school, college, whatever, and she's passed on, you're like, ooh, what do I do here? You respect her. You don't like take advantage of a situation. And I just don't understand who these people are that would take advantage of that system situation. And that's why I say again, that father failed him. He was put in a situation like where he saw a woman he could take advantage of, and he did in the worst way. And then when the father says, hey, my son suffered enough, he got caught, that's where it comes from. That's bad parenting. That's horrible parenting. And I don't want my son to be that way.
You point out that no matter how you live your life, that you're going to come into contact with really difficult situations. So you write about two instances where, while you were not personally involved in domestic violence, you were there.
Yeah.
When it took place.
One of them took place when I was in college in an apartment, two roommates, and I was friends with one of them, and we got the third through an ad in the college paper, like, hey, need a roommate. And he was in a volatile relationship with his girlfriend, and we knew they argued all the time. I was in my bedroom one night, and I heard them arguing, and I'm just like, rolling my eyes, and then I heard it. It was just like, you slap a big steak down on a counter. You just heard this like smack and everything went quiet. And I don't struggle with what I did that night because we did the right thing. Like you sort of struggle with, could we have done more? But I went and got my other room. I said, hey, he just hit his girlfriend. Let's go. We're going to go do something. And my other roommate, my friend, said, yeah, we are. And we walked in there and he took her home. And I told him, you're kicked out of this apartment. And I think that's all we could do at the time. And he left. Like, it wasn't at the end of the month. It wasn't like, you're gone. We're going to put your stuff out on the curb. And there are people saying, like, oh, you could have called the police. Well, she wouldn't have pressed charges. You know, she would have, you know, like, they remained in a relationship, as far as I know, for over a year after that. And the scary thing about that one is, when I talked to my friend about that night, like, I was trying to put it together for the letter. Like, do you remember that time he hit his girlfriend? He went, yeah, yeah, didn't this and this and this happen? And I said, no. And I realized we were talking about two separate instances where, you know, he knew about a case of domestic violence before I did in our apartment. It was just like, oh my gosh, how often had that been going on?
Now, this book is much funnier than we're making it sound.
Yeah,
right,
we went
now.
Light in the first right. segment. This is the dark segment.
Right.
But life is life and dark. There's humor and there's also serious.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you think that your children's disinterest in anything that their dad writes will probably prevent them from reading this, at least reading it for quite some time. Who, you were writing to your son, but you knew it was going to be a book. So did you also imagine that audience? Like, who were you writing to in addition to your son?
No one, because I think that's the best way for me to write, is if I get in my head and go, ooh, who would like to read this? Then I'm pandering, or it becomes less interesting because I'm trying to bend what I feel toward an audience. And I don't think that works. I have to just put what I feel out there, and the people that are going to like it, and the people that don't, won't. And I can't try and cater to anyone, because then I think it's disingenuous, if that makes sense.
What kind of a response have you gotten to the book of letters to your daughter? Who is reading it, and who got in touch with you?
This is horrible, because I'm going to be honest. It's a very split down the center. It's women love it. They give it 5-star reviews on Amazon, and they tell me they love it, and they send me messages. And the response, the first time I heard this from a guy, I laughed it off, like, ah, that's funny. And the second time I heard it, I went, oh, okay. And the third time I heard it, I'm like, okay, now it's a pattern. But what men tell me, and this is not me trying to be funny, is I get, well, you know, each chapter's only a letter, so it's only like a page or two, so I read it while I'm pooping. And that's the most feedback I get from men, is that it's toilet reading. So,
hey, but they're reading it.
They are. So women seem to love it and get something. So maybe the books are me getting in touch with my feminine side. I have no idea. But women tend to respond to it more than men. And when men do respond to it, it's just sort of like, they're not trying to be funny either. When they tell me that, they are being genuine, that's what
that
they
made
read
it
on the
to
toilet.
Any Amazon
right.
reviews? That...
I don't think so. No, they tell me that on the side. If someone wants to put it on Amazon, that's where I read this. Just, you know, wherever you read, I guess.
Well, you reflect quite a bit in the book. At least I feel this reflection about how you have changed as a person after becoming a dad, which is a pretty big life-changing experience for anybody who's ever become a parent. How has it changed you as a comedian to be a dad?
I think I got lucky as a comedian in that I used to be very dark and sarcastic and bitter. And I actually had one of the first comedy club I actually ever went to back when I got my start in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She told me, like, you're too young to be this angry. Audiences aren't going to get it because you're just too bitter. And I'm still dark, and I still have sarcasm, and I see the world and get angry at certain things, but being a dad has softened to me to where it's palatable, where audiences laugh, and I can say something that's dark, but it doesn't have that bitter, angry edge. It just has that this is life to it. Like, now I'm just sort of talking. I don't have the seething behind it. I just have the sort of maybe general confusion, like, how does this happen in life? So it's still can be a topic that could be off-putting if presented wrong or incorrectly, but hopefully now I have a better, and maybe that's just getting better as a comedian, but maybe being softer and being a dad and having more, I hate what I'm about to say, maybe being loving in general opens that up and allows audiences to accept me more.
Are your kids a big part of your act?
They are, yes. There are certain things like potty training where, as sad as it is, you have to talk about poop on stage. You have to talk about the fact that when you have a little baby girl in diapers, that poop makes its way out the front and all the way up to the chin. And I don't get how, but you got to talk about it. You got to talk about them any way you can.
So as they get older, have you thought about that? Because at some point you're going to get... you're going to have consent issues with your kids saying, hey, Dad, you can't talk about me on stage.
Yeah, well, when they're 18, they can file lawsuits against me. Right now, I think I only have one. No, I don't. Maybe she could call in. My wife asked me to drop a joke once when her grandparents were in the audience. But other than that, she's never really given me a, you know, don't talk about this on stage. So she's pretty good with that. And hopefully the kids will be open to. Well, they'll go through their teenage years when they aren't, but... I'm old, so I'll be dead by the time they're teenagers. What do I know?
One of the things that you wrote to both of your kids about, and I've interviewed your wife on the program about fertility treatments that you guys went through to be able to have kids. You went through a lot to be able to have kids. And that's a story that you told both of your kids in both the books. Why do you think that's so important for them to know someday?
Well, with the... with my daughter, it was just a story. I believe it was like, this is how you came to be. You deserve to know. With my son, I think it was more, this is why you don't have any younger siblings, because we donated our remaining embryos to a couple that was also infertile, which we tried to give them the gift of parenthood.
Right. And that's what I talked to your wife about.
Exactly. And so that was a question if he might come up with today. Is like, why did you stop at two? And it's like, well... we felt our family was complete. That was it. It was literally like we had the two of you, we had mom and dad, we had the dog, and we feel complete as a family. We didn't need to add one more. And this is what happened to your possible brother and sisters, is they went and nothing happened. The embryos did not take. I don't know if you ever did a follow-up, but that they are a family now. They got embryos from somewhere else and just had a child.
Oh, that's very exciting.
I don't know what gender. My wife's going to be angry at me because she's told me. But our embryos did not take, but that family did become a full family with a child with different embryos. But yeah, that's what I tell my son is we tried to, we got very lucky with you and your sister, and we tried to give that blessing to another family, that luck, that crossed finger hope.
You write about your relationship again in both books, but you write about it differently for your son. You actually give him quite a lot of dating advice, relationship advice, and share stories from your dating life as well. A little more openly, I think, than you did in your book with your daughter. What do you want him to know?
First of all, I know that I did that, and I felt embarrassed that I was doing that. Not embarrassed, like I realized that I don't know if this is sexist or maybe it is just a father-son thing, but I realized like I'm writing to you differently than I wrote to your sister. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing or if we're supposed to be gender neutral. Like I should talk to both of you the same way, but I realized I did it, but then I kept doing it because it's like, well, this is just how it feels to write this. But what do I want him to take away? Oh, there are so many letters in there that I wrote about dating. I basically don't make the same mistakes I did, especially with my first girlfriend, which is don't put all your eggs into that one basket where, you know, if it doesn't work out, yeah, you might have felt you were in love and you're heartbroken, but keep moving forward because I went through three relationships to find your mom. And when I found her, it was like, oh, now I get it. This is why these other ones didn't work out. And I think I kind of told my daughter that as well. So, yeah, I can't think of any, I apologize, any specific example where I can say, yeah, I told my daughter this and my son this. Other than consent and, well, maybe I did tell him one story about friends with benefits and how to be careful with that. Like, maybe you can do it if you feel it's there and maybe you shouldn't. I don't know.
So now that you have published the second book, do you find yourself still writing letters to the kids?
I think I'm going to write a letter to the dog now. I think I'm going to write a series of letters like, who's a good boy? Who's a good boy? It'll just be so much easier for me, I think. I think I'm going to, now, if there's going to be another one, it'll be a joint. I haven't started writing yet. Maybe I've taken notes like, and this is going to sound silly, and I apologize. Facebook status is like, today this happened, and like, oh, well, that was a neat moment. And if I can expand those into letters to the two of them, we'll see what happens.
What's next for you?
Just telling jokes. just trying to get back out there on the road and continually telling jokes. And then when the hotel becomes me staring at walls, hopefully writing more letters.
So you you do share career frustrations with your son as well in these letters. You write a lot about, you know, how sometimes things don't go well. Is that important to you to make sure that your kids see not only your success, but also your failures?
I don't know that I've had success. So sure, they're going to see my failures because they're going to live with it. What I tell my son is, and this comedy's not a merit-based industry where I use a quote from Jason Bateman in the book. He was giving an interview where he said, if you go to the factory or you work in an office, you put in those extra hours, you're going to get a bonus. Your boss is going to notice, hey, he's a hard worker. You're going to get that promotion. And Jason Bateman said, acting's not like that. You can be the best actor in the world and go undiscovered your whole life. And my wife heard that, and she's like, yeah, that sounds like comedy. And so what I warn both children against, specifically the son, because it came up here because of the Bateman interview, is maybe do something merit-based. I don't know that I want you to be a comedian because there's a lot of heartbreak in this industry.
Well, Nathan Timmel, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. It was very nice to be here.
Nathan Timmel is a stand-up comedian. He lives in the Iowa City area, and he just published his latest book. It's a letter, or it's a book full of letters to his young son. It's called Hey Buddy, Dubious Advice from Dad. Coming up in just a moment, the story of Jamberry the horse and her amazing survival. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you've ever taken a psychology class, you've probably heard the story of Phineas Gage. He was a railroad worker who survived a terrible accident in which an iron rod was driven through his head. He's remembered in the psychology books because that accident taught us a whole lot about how the brain works. But that's not why we're talking about him today. We're talking about him because a beautiful horse named Jamberry had a very similar accident. Dr. Stephanie Kasten is an associate professor of equine surgery at Iowa State University. She is the vet who saved Jamberry. Dr. Kasten, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And now, nobody was there with Jamberry when this happened, but tell me what we think happened.
Yes, correct. The owners actually found her with the metal pole in her head in the morning when they went to do chores, and they had done chores the previous night and everyone was fine, and they found her early the next morning like this. So she was alone when it happened, but the best that we can figure is that she was grazing through the fence, and the fence in this case was made of metal panels that are welded on each, bars were welded on each end, and she probably was trying to eat grass on the other side and push through. And one of the poles had a loose weld and was able to push her head through, and then that loose end got stuck behind her jaw when she tried to pull back. And in the process of trying to free herself, it seems that she not only drove the rod through her head, but then it became disconnected at the other end as well. So when they found her in the morning, they found her with this entire metal pole, which I estimate was about 8 feet long, all the way through her head, and then she was just standing in the middle of the paddock.
Wow. And I can imagine that having something like this happen, this could have killed her instantly, I would think. So the pole had gone through her head. I also imagine the horror that they responded to finding her with. What did they do?
Right. So they were, of course, horrified, and they immediately called their local veterinarian to come out and help them. And they, of course, weren't quite sure what to do, but she was standing. She was stable. Their veterinarian arrived on the scene and assessed her. And certainly, yes, it could have been a fatal injury, but she was lucky enough that it did go through some structures that were important, but she actually didn't damage any structures that would have instantly caused her death. And their veterinarian worked with them to get her on in the trailer and transported to us. So she had to be transported in a trailer, and they worked to make sure that even though the pole was still in her head, that it wouldn't hit anything in the trailer, and secured her, and then sent her on her way to us so that we could do surgery and stabilize her further.
Now, I can imagine a vet looking at this and saying, we should put this horse down because this is this is a terrible injury and we don't want her to suffer. What was the evidence that made the local vet think, okay, actually, we can probably help her?
Well, you know, that's a good point. It's always assessment on the scene can be difficult, and it's always a decision that you have to make. But again, the fact that she was standing and she was stable allowed him to be able to assess her vital signs, and she actually could walk around of her own volition. And he didn't know, of course, at first, and neither did we, what all she had damaged and whether it would be feasible to save her. But the owners were very dedicated and willing to try. And so he called us and said, I've got this horse. I don't know exactly what all is involved, but they would like to save her if they can. And she's standing and moving. We're able to get her on a trailer, so we want to send her to you.
All right. So she got to you. She still had this pole through her head, because that's not the kind of thing you just pull out.
Right.
What did you do?
Well, one of the first things that we did when she walked in the door, we put a catheter in so that we could start to give her some fluid. She had lost quite a bit of blood, as you can imagine. And because of that, she needed some replacement. And we started assessing her again, what was her heart rate, that sort of thing. And then pretty quickly thereafter, after we had given her a little sedation and pain meds to calm her and make it easier for her, we actually cut the pole off so that it was quite a bit shorter, so that we could then maneuver her around the hospital, take x-rays without having that whole long part of the pole sticking out. And then we didn't remove it until later. But that the first thing we did was really stabilize her, assess her condition, and then shorten the pole.
So once you had the pole cut down and you decided it was time to remove it, tell me about that surgery. How did that go?
Well, we had some concern that there may be something that would start bleeding when we removed it. So we did take x-rays first with the pole in place. And those were some of the pictures, you know, that people have seen online. You know, they've seen the x-rays with this pretty dramatic looking large metal object in the head.
Yes.
And so that part gave us an idea of where it went, because behind the jaw where it entered, there is a structure called the guttural pouch, and it contains the carotid arteries. And that was a real concern, that perhaps the pole was holding off one of these vessels, and we removed it, there may be massive bleeding or some other decompensation. So when we removed the pole, she was already asleep. So we went ahead and anesthetized her first so that we had control of the situation. She wasn't moving. She wasn't worried or in distress. And we removed the pole. And she did have one vessel that was bleeding that I clamped off right away. But amazingly, and again, that's part of the interesting part of this story, amazingly, she had missed all of those carotid arteries and most of the large nerves that lie right there with them. And we were able to then roll her into surgery and start basically doing wound repair at that point and piecing together some of the skin and of course, cleaning the wound. Because once we removed the pole, all of the debris and metal flakes that had come with the pole needed to be removed or lavaged out with saline, that sort of thing.
After surgery, what were your major concerns? You knew you had stopped the bleeding, but again, I mean, this is her brain. This is her head. What were your major concerns as she began to come out of anesthesia?
Yeah, so our major concerns at this point were really nerve function, because after we had removed the pole, we did take her and we did a CT scan or CAT scan. So that gave us a little better idea of the exact path of the pole. And we knew that it hadn't gotten into the brain, as in the Phineas Gage case, you know, he damaged to his brain, but she had just narrowly missed the brain.
Okay.
And the pole had gone through the sinus. We knew she had missed those vessels when we pulled the pole out, but it had destroyed part of her pharyngeal area, which is the back of the throat near where the esophagus is. And we knew that there was some nerve damage. She had avoided a lot of the major nerves that help function with swallowing, that sort of thing. But she did have some nerve damage. And so our biggest concern was she going to be able to eat so that she could maintain her own nutrition and hydration? And she was pretty amazing and pretty tough. She woke up after surgery and went back to the stall, and when she was awake enough, I offered her a handful of hay, and she actually took a bite, and it was quite slow and a little bit incoordinated because she did have some nerve damage, but she was actually able to eat starting the day that we woke her up from surgery.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, and there's an additional part to this story. Jamberry is pregnant, right?
Right, right. And that's one of the things, of course, that prompted the owners to, really make sure that they were going to every effort to see if there were any options for her, because she was carrying a valuable foal, and the foal did well. We checked it often while she was in the hospital, and one of our reproductive specialists even did an ultrasound at one point and did fetal sexing, which tells us that it appeared that it's a filly, which the owners were very excited about because they wanted a girl, and she's still pregnant and due to foal this spring. So that part was icing on the cake to the rest of the case.
Yeah. How long did she stay with you at the hospital?
She was with us for a little under 2 months, I believe. She didn't necessarily need to stay that long, but the owners had to travel and they wanted to leave her with us rather than, having to have someone take care of her at home.
A pet sitter. Right?
Yep. Yeah, you don't want to leave your pet sitter with a horse with a hole in its head.
Oh my goodness. And how did things heal?
Well, she healed quite well. We did have some tissue that died off, which, as you can imagine, if there was that much trauma to the tissues, even if we clean everything up and suture it back together, some of it lost blood supply. And so in the process of the body cleaning itself up, they will have what's called sloughing of the tissue. So the tissue will die off and then be replaced by new tissue as it kind of contracts in. And so she looked really great for the first few days, and then she started to have some of this tissue dying off. So we had to do a lot of wound care as we went. And we also were flushing her sinus because, of course, this had entered her sinus. So we would daily lavage her sinus in the early days after surgery. But it came down over the long term to a lot of wound care because she did have to heal some of this on her own, despite the fact that we sutured some of it because of that death of the tissue right. from such trauma.
What do you think her prognosis is long term? I know that, the embryo is doing well, and she's expected to carry it to full term. What do you think about her life after that?
Yeah, she does have some permanent dysfunction. It's mild, but she does have a little bit of difficulty eating, in that she's just a little bit slower than she maybe normally would be. And she does have some chronic nasal discharge. So I think in that respect, she probably will have those. It's been long enough that if she was going to recover, it's unlikely that things are going to change at this point, but those are pretty minor and she functions pretty much like a normal horse other than that. So I think that, of course, if she was going to have more foals in the future, that certainly would be easy enough for her to do. So the prognosis there is excellent. She may not be, a show horse because she has some scars and that sort of thing, but I don't think that was ever the intention for her. And if she was able to have foals or live out her life in a pasture, I think that everyone would be quite happy with that.
Now, this is obviously a bizarre and unusual case. You treat a lot of horses, though, and horses have a tendency to have kind of crazy injuries like this.
They do, actually. They are prey animals, and they do have a strong fight or flight response at times, and certainly depends on the horse. But a lot of them, if they're scared, their reaction is not to just stand still and think about it. Their reaction is to try and get away, to try and run, to try and get out of whatever predicament they're in. And, in her case, that seems to be exactly what happened, is that she got caught, and so instead of waiting for someone to come and help her, she tried to free herself and ended up with this pole that went through her head. And we see a lot of injuries on, horses live outside. So fences or other things, even such as, wood. I've seen sticks and other things that just again, an improbable accident that the horse stepped on it and it just happened to impale itself, or it got a laceration. There's so many different injuries that they get because of the nature of where they live and their reaction to their environment.
There are some really macabre jokes about it. And there's, I think, this idea that horses are not easy to treat, that if a horse gets a bad injury, they're almost always euthanized. I remember a Far Side cartoon.
Yes.
About the equine chapter of veterinary medicine, and all of the, you know, the answers were shoot the horse, shoot the
yes.
horse, shoot the horse. So tell me more about equine medicine, because clearly we've come a long way.
We have come a long way. And, you know, that used to be the case to some degree, that a lot of these serious injuries, the best option was humane euthanasia. But we have made a lot of advancements. We do still have limitations because of their size. So some of the fractures and other injuries that we can fix in people or in small animals, for instance, some of the larger bones up higher, the femur in an adult horse, those are oftentimes difficult to impossible to fix, depending on the fracture configuration, because again, you have an animal that weighs 1,200 to 2,000 pounds, and the implants that we have available to fix fractures like that simply won't hold up to the horse's weight. And sometimes they won't tolerate some certain treatments just because it's difficult for them to live that way. So for instance, very difficult for them to live on three legs, whereas we see dogs with amputated legs all the time. So we've made a lot of strides, but we are still limited just because of their sheer size.
Now, you've made these incredible strides scientifically in medicine, but at the same time, we seem to be dealing with a real shortage of veterinarians in rural areas and large animal vets.
Right, we are, and that's something that people at both our college and other colleges have been working on. We'd like to encourage veterinary students to consider practicing in rural areas and practicing on horses and other large animal species, because we do have a shortage, and it seems that many people end up wanting to practice either in cities, or they want to specialize in small animal medicine or surgery. And part of that, I think, is, you know, the lifestyle. It is a little bit different lifestyle to be a rural veterinarian and to work on large animals than it is to work in a small animal clinic, because you do have to often go out in the field. There may be longer hours, there may be less people, especially in a rural setting. If you're the only veterinarian in town, there are less people to take emergency calls. So if you're the only veterinarian in town, you may be the one who gets called for everything. And so having more people wanting to enter that field, I think, will help with that. And, you know, there are several other reasons, too, likely why rural veterinarians are at a shortage. And part of that probably has to do with student debt, because, as you know, not just with veterinarians, but with other students, a high debt load is a problem if you think that your income might be lower in one part of the profession than it wouldn't be in another.
And Congress is considering the Veterinary Medicine Loan Repayment Act, an idea that would help repay veterinary student loans if they choose to serve in rural areas, and an issue or a way to possibly address that shortage.
Right. And I think that would be great. There is a loan repayment plan that some veterinarians have participated in that worked in teaching professions, that sort of thing. But I think the rural programs are very important. We need to get veterinarians back out to these places so that people with animals get good care. You know, animals are very important to people. They're not only part of their livelihood, they're part of their families in a lot of cases, whether they be small animals or large. So I think it's good that, you know, that program is a possibility. But I think as veterinary schools, too, we need to try and promote those professions to our students.
Well, Dr. Kasten, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yes, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me, Charity.
Dr. Stephanie Kasten is an associate professor of equine surgery at Iowa State University. She is the vet who saved the horse, Jamberry. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.